of Alcoholics Anonymous to share some of those moments with us tonight. Please welcome Bill W. Bill.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry I'm late, folks. It was a chance that we weren't going to even get here tonight. I understand some of you in the hall already know what has happened today, but it's come as a terrible shock. Let me read the telegram that we received 1 o'clock this afternoon. Dear Uncle Bill, well, it's addressed to William G. Wilson, the Alcoholic Foundation, New York, New York. Dear Uncle Bill, Dad slipped away peacefully at noon today at the Akron Hospital. We'll call you later with the funeral arrangements. Our love to you and Aunt Lois. And it's signed Sue and Bob Jr. Dr. Bob, my partner, your friend, our friend, died today. As I said, I wasn't going to come, but Lois, my wife, said, what better place could you come to than a meeting of Bob's friends? And I also got a call from Ed Dowling, Father Ed down in St. Louis, and he said, go, it'll do you a lot of good. He said, just don't talk about yourself. Talk about Bob. Talk about the beginning. Tell our story. Don't just tell your story. He said, make it an Irish wake. And thinking about that, I decided that I would come, and I will share with you. So please, if I'm a little out of kilt here, just realize that I got some tragic news today. I did, though, on the way over, take a minute to jot down a few notes to sort of commemorate the event of this group's anniversary. And with your permission, I'd like to get that out of the way before we begin the meeting. We meet tonight to celebrate this group's anniversary, first anniversary, in the life of Dr. Bob Smith. We thank God that he has freed many of us out of bondage. And we're here to tell all our friends about deep gratitude for all the help they have given us in this wholesale miracle of recovery, and to share with them and with each other the sure evidence of God's grace among us. So much for speech making. We don't make speeches, we just tell our stories. Tonight, though, it'll be a little bit different. It'll be our story. Well, let me see, where do I begin? I guess for us, for me anyway, the beginning was 16 years ago, 1934, the end of the summer, September. I was a patient up in Charlie Towns' hospital, up on Central Park West. I had been a patient there before. This was my fourth visit, third time that year. And I was upstairs, wrapped up in one of Charlie's canvas pajama tops. You remember the ones that tied in the back? And my wife, Lois, she was downstairs. She was talking to Dr. Silkworth, and he was telling her what he had just maybe an hour or so before told me. He was telling her that my drinking, which had once been just a habit, had now become an obsession, and that my body at last had developed an allergy to the very substance that I craved, and that I was dying, and that I was an alcoholic. He had this concept, this theory, after treating thousands of men like myself, that mine was a disease as any other disease, and a disease that was sure to kill me if I was left to my own. And it was his earnest suggestion that Lois commit me into the Rockland State Hospital for the insane. You could do that then as a chronic inebriate, and he wanted to do that because he knew I was killing myself. But all Lois could say is, but doctor, you don't understand. I never met a man like Bill who, when he made his mind up, could do anything. Why can't he stop this drinking? And again, he repeated, he has a disease. Hard to understand, harder to treat, but a disease nevertheless. And that he better follow his advice. Lois, of course, was distraught, and I was upstairs going over those words myself, and I was just as distraught, just trying to say, why me? You know, typically alcoholic, why me? Why did this happen to me? And I went back over my life, and I could see certain events perhaps that brought me on the road to it, but why me? I did not set out to be this way. Perhaps if I had to look for a reason, was the fact that my father had a problem with alcohol. That was the reason for my parents' divorce when I was 8 years old. My sister and I and my mother were abandoned by my father as a result of his drinking. My mother left shortly. I was made to live with my grandparents, my mother's parents. My grandfather instilled in me at an early age a strong, strong desire to be number one. And I guess the capstone of all of that was At 12, in my earnest rush to be number one, I invented, or was in the record books as an inventor, the first American boomerang. I had gotten a book from Grandpa when I was 12 on my birthday that, in passing it to me, he said, you know, the Aborigine is the only fellow that can make a boomerang. And I just went after that tooth and nail to prove that I could be an equal to an Aborigine. And after 6 months, a six-month power drive, I created the first boomerang. It worked. And from that day on, my grandfather started it off. I was a number one man in his eyes and as far as he was concerned in everybody else's eyes. Little realizing at the time that I was setting up an emotional boomerang that was going to last me the rest of my life. The need to be number one in everything I did. So perhaps that was the reason for my turning alcoholic. I only drank for 17 years, picked up my first drink when I was 22 in the Army. Stationed up in Massachusetts with my wife. 22, 17 years later, I'm lying in a hospital bed, an alcoholic. Made a fortune in those 17 years and lost it. Not much to my fault, but some of it, but a lot of it due to the crash in 29. That began the in and outs of the institutions, because when that happened, I also crashed, and I was a hopeless drunk. A lot of problems with alcohol. In and out of sanitariums, drying out places, hospitals, rest homes. Lost everything we had. Everything. Now here I am, 39 years old, and a doctor wants to put me in the hospital for the rest of my life. Well, I begged Lois not to follow his advice. When she came to see me, I begged her to give me one more chance, and God bless her, she did. And she brought me home to our home. In reality, it wasn't our home, it was my brother-in-law's. We were living rent-free over on Clinton Street in Brooklyn Heights. Lois had a job in a downtown Brooklyn department store making $22 a week. Everything we had that was of any value had been sold long before this. And I was a chronic drunk. But she brought me home anyway, and she gave me that one last chance. And in the next 2 months, I proved the doctor wrong. Totally, absolutely wrong. I didn't leave the house, but I got sober. Stark raving sober, I guess you'd call it, but I got sober. After 2 months of just staying inside that house, I knew that the doctor had made a mistake. I was not an alcoholic. I was not a drunk. And then Armistice Day, 1934, beautiful, smashing day, positively brilliant. I looked out the window after breakfast and seeing how great it was, I said to my wife, Lois, I said, honey, I want to play some golf today. This is perhaps the last good day of the year and I want to get in a round of golf before winter sets in. I felt like $1 million. And she tried to stop me as best she could. She said, Bill, get stronger. But I insisted. And finally she relented and she gave me a few dollars and I went up to the attic and I dug out the old golf bag and walked down to the Staten Island Ferry. The club was over in Staten Island. Actually, it was my brother-in-law's club. I could play and he'd pay. But I walked to the ferry, took the ride over, and as I said, it was a positively beautiful day and I felt like $1 million. On the other side, I boarded the bus to take me to the clubhouse, and on getting on the bus, I noticed a fellow that was carrying a rifle. Now, I don't know about you, but in New York, if I see somebody with a gun, I want to keep a good eye on him. So I decided the best thing for me to do was to sit alongside him. And after a few stops, I said to him, hey, mister, where are you going with that rifle? And he just told me, he said, I'm going to a shooting match. And as it turned out, it was at a gun club right next door to the very golf course that I was going to play on. There was this gun club. And he was going to shoot that afternoon. Now, having raised in Vermont, I fancied that I knew everything there was about rifles, and I began to tell him everything I knew. As it turned out, he knew a lot more than I did, so at the end of it, just to be number one in the conversation, I threw in what I knew about the artillery, having been in the artillery during the First World War. And lo and behold, I became number one in the conversation. He was impressed. And we were settling down for a very comfortable ride when all of a sudden the bus was rear-ended by a taxi cab. We had to unload to see the damage, and there wasn't much, just a few bumps and bruises, but nothing of any significance. But it was sufficient that the bus driver, had to wait to make out a police report. So they called for a replacement bus to continue the trip. Well, we're standing on the curb, my newfound friend and I, when he spots an old speakeasy across the street. And he says to me, why don't we wait there? He said, it'd be a lot more comfortable, and the driver can come for us when the new bus arrives. I said, it sounded like a good idea to me. So we crossed the street, and we knocked on the door, and they opened it up for us, and we got in and sat at the bar, and the bartender came up and said to my friend, he said, "What will you have?" And he asked for a whiskey and ginger ale, as I recall. And of me, they said, "What would you like?" And I said, "Just a ginger ale, thank you." And he turned to me, my newfound friend, and he said, "You don't drink?" And I said, "No, I don't drink." And then for some reason that I'm still, to this day, not quite sure why, I decided to tell him my life story with alcohol, blow by blow, dollar by dollar, hospital by hospital, everything that I lost, everything over the years that caused me pain and horror and heartbreak and just everything. And he listened. And when I finished, he said a wondrous thing to me. He said, "You know, you're a remarkable man." And immediately I knew that he was an intelligent man, because nobody, and I mean nobody, had had a kind word to say to me in years. But this man could see through all of me and get to the very nub of it and see that I was a number one, a highly intelligent man. He said, as I recall, "I have a number of friends that have had problems with alcohol, much like your own." He said, "They're dead now, or they're in prison, or they're in hospitals, or they're in Skid Row. But you seem to have rebounded, to have recovered." And I think that's highly remarkable. The more he talked, the smarter he got in front of me. It was just, as I said, nobody, and I mean nobody, had had a kind word for me. Well, good things have to come to an end, and the driver finally came and told us about the new bus, and we boarded and continued our trip. After a mile or so, I didn't want to let this fellow loose. As I said, I needed this affirmation. So I said, "Why don't you join me for lunch at my club?" It was my brother-in-law's, but as far as he was concerned, it was my club. "I'll stand you to lunch, because you're not going to start shooting," as he had told me, "until 2 o'clock, and I wasn't going to tee off until 1:30, and it was just a few minutes before noon. I said, "Why don't you join me? We'll have lunch, and at the end of lunch, you can walk out the back door of the clubhouse and cross a small field, and you'll be at the gun club in a matter of minutes." And he liked the idea, and he agreed. So when my stop came, we both got off and entered into the country club. And we were walking to the dining room when we were stopped by the manager, and he said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "No, we're just going for a bite of lunch." And he said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I apologize, but the dining room is closed today in celebration of Armistice Day. We've given the staff the day off. But you can, if you'd like, you can get a sandwich in the bar." My friend said to me, "Will that bother you?" And I said, "No, not at all. I've already passed the test. I'd gotten out of that saloon in one piece. I'm sure I could do it again." So we crossed over, and we went into the bar and sat up on the bar stools, and eventually the bartender came over to serve us, and he said, "What will you have?" And my friend again asked for a whiskey and ginger ale, and I asked for a ginger ale, and we ordered sandwiches. And my friend, as I said, who was getting smarter by the minute, he said, "You know, you're fantastic." He said, "You're in a sea of alcohol." And there were bottles all over the place. I mean, it was just loaded with every type of liquor you could imagine. He said, "You are remarkable. You're just absolutely a wonder, because you're in a sea of booze, and it's still not pulling at you." And I knew that I was cured. The doctor had made a mistake. I was so delighted. I couldn't wait to tell my wife. Well, we drank our drinks and we ate our sandwiches, and finally I asked the bartender for the bill so I could sign it so my brother-in-law wouldn't have any problems paying it. We were about ready to leave when the bartender came back over, and he put down two mixed drinks, one in front of me and one in front of my friend. And he said, "Gentlemen, these drinks are on the house in celebration of Armistice Day." Without a moment's hesitation, I reached over and I picked up mine and I drank it down. When I turned to my newfound friend, he didn't look smart anymore. He had the dumbest expression I've ever seen on a human being. And all he could say to me is, "Mister, you've got to be crazy. Absolutely crazy. After what alcohol has done to you, for you to take that drink, you must be insane." And all I could say was, "You're right, I am insane. I am crazy." That night, my wife found me in the areaway, the space between the outside door and the inside door of our home. I had fallen, apparently cut my head, and I was bleeding, passed out. Still clutching that bag of unused golf clubs. I didn't play golf that day. I got drunk and proved the doctor right. The next morning, full of remorse and pain and self-pity, I knew what I was. I knew that I was an alcoholic. and I'd be one the rest of my life. And I guess when I died and they pulled the grass over my head, I'd be a dead alcoholic, and there was nothing I could do about it. But I also knew that I'd be damned before I'd die in some insane asylum. I decided then and there that I would drink myself to death or get the Dutch courage that I needed to take my life. And that's what I set out to do. For the next several weeks, I begged, borrowed, or stole the dollar bill it took to get the three little bottles of gin that it also took to get me over the edge, to get me drunk. Day in and day out, I sat in that empty house in Brooklyn, drinking myself to death, occasionally writing angry letters to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, telling him what a lousy job he was doing running the country. Letters I want to assure you right now he never replied to. I don't think Lois ever mailed them. But that was my future, and that was my end, and I couldn't care less. That's how Ebby found me. Ebby T, some of you might know, from the rooms. Got a call one day. Old Ebby, my school chum, he said, "Hey, Bill, this is Eb. Can I come over to see you?" And I said, "Oh, Ebby, please, please do. I hated to drink alone. I truly did." Here was my old pal coming over to share an afternoon. We could reminisce and talk about the old days, and it would be wonderful. I said, "Oh, please come over, Eb." And he said he'd be right over. And I then did what I consider to be a very heroic act for a drunk of my nature. I dug out the one little bottle of gin that I had sequestered behind the commode in the downstairs john. And I put that on the kitchen table. And because I remembered that Ebby had a kind of a sour stomach, I also rescued a can of pineapple juice from one of Lois's pantry shelves. And I put that on the table and waited for my friend, looking forward to a splendid afternoon, because I was sure he'd bring a jug too, and we'd have a great time. And while I was waiting, I was trying to recall an event that friends of ours, friends of Ebby and I, had passed on to me about him being in a kind of a scrape not too long ago, maybe a month or so before his call today. And it seemed that Eb, in one of his binges, had run his car into somebody's living room up near Albany. And when he climbed out of the wreckage, there was a woman sitting on the sofa, and he said to her, "Madam, would you please get me a cup of coffee?" And we all laughed about it because she got the cops instead. I must ask him when he comes, "How did you get out of that scrape, Ebby? I'd like to know for future reference." That was a real, real bad scrape. I must ask him. Well, I didn't have long to wait. There was a knock on the door, and I went to answer it. And as soon as I opened it and took one look, I knew that something had changed. There was something different about him. He was clean, for one. His suit was nicely sponged and pressed. He had a blocked hat, and his shoes were shined, and he was clean shaven. I knew how I looked. I always knew how I looked. I had a pair of baggy trousers, wearing an undershirt, 3 or 4 day growth of beard. I used to go around with my brother-in-law's house slippers on. They were a size and a half too big for me, so I couldn't walk exactly. I had to slide around the house. Lois used to love that. She used to say to friends, "He polishes the linoleum wherever he goes." And that's how I looked. Well, we said a few pleasantries in the parlor, and finally I said, "Ebby, let's go back to the kitchen where it's a lot warmer," and where I knew the gin was. I also happened to notice, by the way, that he wasn't carrying a jug. He was empty-handed. Maybe he's broke. Well, he followed me back, and we sat at the kitchen table, and we shared a few more pleasantries, and finally both of us are eyeing the bottle of gin and the can of pineapple juice. I said to him, "Eb, how would you like a little drink?" And I reached over and I started to pour one out. And he said, "No, Bill." He said, "No, thank you, not today." I said, "You're not drinking?" I said, "You on the water wagon, Ebby?" He said, "No, I'm not. I'm just not drinking today." "So what happened, old friend? This is news to me." He said, "Well, I guess you could say I got religion." Oh, my God, I thought, I've let a religious nut in my house. And then I realized, well, that isn't such bad news, because now all this liquor is mine. I don't have to share it. And I'm sure it'll outlast any rantings and ravings he might have about whatever religion he picked up. So I said, what religion have you found, Ed? And he said, very matter-of-factly, he said, "I guess you'd call it the religion of common sense." I had never heard of Our Lady of the Common Sense, so I dug a little further. I said, "What do you mean, common sense?" Well, he said, Bill, I don't know if you realize how much of a grip alcohol had on me. And right away, I knew I wasn't going to tell him about what I knew. I said, no, Ab. I said, you have a problem with alcohol? He said, oh, yeah. He said, a very, very severe problem. Why, just a little over a month ago, he says, I was in a judge's chambers, and they were getting ready to throw the book at me and lock me up. I had gotten into the one scrape too many, and my family wanted me off the streets. And while I was in that chamber, friends of ours, and he mentioned their names, and they were friends of mine, too, and he said, also a perfect stranger, he mentioned his name, and he was a stranger to me also. He said, these people came to that hearing. And this stranger stood before the judge, and he said, Your Honor, turn him over to us. I think we can help him solve his problem. They're members of the Oxford group, Bill. Have you ever heard of those? And I had. I said, yes, I know a little about them, having read some articles and some stories over the years in the society columns, a bunch of fancy dance that got together to overcome whatever drinking or drugging or gambling problems they might have. But it was a subject that I didn't want to know that much about, so I said, I don't know that much. He said, well, he said, I got involved with these people. The judge had nothing to lose, so he just turned me over to him. And after a while, listening to him, I took certain ideas peculiar to them, and I put it to work on my drinking problem. And it seems to have done the trick for me. Well, if you're in for a penny, you're in for a pound. And I said, well, what are those ideas, my friend? And he said, well, number one, I had to get honest with myself for the first time in my life and take a look at what alcohol had done to me. And then he said, I had to talk it over with somebody else. In strict confidence, now, I want to assure you that. In strict confidence, I had to talk it out with somebody else. And then he said, I had to become willing to make up for all the harm that I've done with my drinking and with other things. I'll be doing that the rest of my life. Then also he said, I had to also become willing to help people like myself. And when I heard that old Bill Wilson was holed up over in Brooklyn drinking himself to death, I said to my friends, let me take a crack at him. And that's why I'm here today. Well, I was offended. I said, wait a minute, Ab, I don't know who gave you that idea that I was drinking myself to death, but you're wrong. I might be having a couple of bad spots here, but I'm certainly not doing that. Well, I said, all right, I could be mistaken, he said. And I said, well, is that what you picked up all the ideas? He said, no, there was one other. And he says, I know it's going to jar you, Bill, but I have to tell you this nevertheless. I know where you stand on this issue, but I had to also come up with asking God for help to do those other four things to keep me straight and keep me on the beam. I had to ask whatever God I could come up with for help. And I know that jars you. And he was right. And I said to him, thank you, but no thanks. And we got up and I walked him to the door and I saw him off. So much for a pleasant afternoon with my friend Ab. The idea, somebody coming into my house and talking about some personal arrangement with a god was just absolutely ridiculous. I'm an engineer by training, and I do allow for the natural order of things, and I can conceivably consider a supreme consciousness. But the idea of some personal deity that you can help overcome life's problems was absolutely ludicrous. So much for my friend Ebby. I went back to drinking. But a funny thing happened over the next couple of days. I couldn't get the sight of Ebby out of my mind. He became another obsession. All I could do was think of him sober and me drunk. I knew what I was. And I kept saying, there's something wrong with this picture. What's wrong? And eventually I realized I should be sober. Because I was the number one man. I was number one in everything. I should be sober. I should be the one talking to the likes of Ebby. There's something wrong about this. And the obsession grew and grew and grew until finally I began to realization, I guess you'd call it, a moment there, some brief moment. I began to realize that had I cancer, and Ebby showed up and he told me about a cure for cancer that was in the hands of some, quote, great physician, unquote, I would have followed him on my hands and knees to wherever that physician was located, had I cancer. And yet I had a disease much like cancer. It was killing me. And I wouldn't do anything about it. The more I thought about it, the more I realized that I was definitely insane. But I had to check this out. I made a living as an investigator, as a security analyst. I could analyze this Oxford group. I could take a good, hard look at them and see perhaps if they could help me. I could do it on the QT. Nobody would have to know. Perhaps Lois, but nobody else. Maybe Ebby, if he saw me there. But I would go over to where they met, and I'd observe them. And if they had something for me, perhaps I'd take what I want and leave the rest behind. So I told Lois about my idea one evening, and she, God bless her, she helped me. The next day, we cleaned me up. And finally, that afternoon, with a few dollars that she gave me, I took the subway into Manhattan to check out the Oxford group. They used to meet over at the Calvary Mission on 23rd Street. Some of you might remember the place. And I, coming up out of the subway, realized immediately that I had made a great mistake. I'd taken the subway over from Brooklyn. I went over to the west side of Manhattan instead of the east side where the mission was, which happens to be also the longest stretch in New York from the east to the west. And because it was early, I decided, well, it isn't too bad. It wasn't a bad day. I'd walk over. I had plenty of time. I'd just walk over the few blocks and be there in plenty of time for the meeting. After a few blocks of walking, though, I found myself looking into the windows of some of the saloons that I passed by to see perhaps if there was somebody there I might know. There wasn't. I continued to walk until finally, in desperation, because I was getting closer to the mission, I crossed the street to one of my favorite watering holes. I looked in that window, and there was nobody there that I knew, so I decided perhaps I was missing something. I'd step inside to take a really good look. I stepped inside, and I looked around, and again, there was nobody there I knew, so I thought, why don't you wait? Perhaps somebody's going to show up. And I waited. Now, I don't know about you, but if you're going to wait in a saloon, you should have a drink, because otherwise you'll look conspicuous. So I asked for a beer. I drank it, and then I asked for another beer. Another beer and a shot to go with it. Before you know it, I forgot any plans I had for an evening that hadn't even begun yet. I went into my usual blackout. So much for meeting God in Manhattan. But as also was my custom, in a little while I came out of the blackout. I found myself talking to a man with a very heavy accent. As it determined after a minute, he was a fisherman from a Finnish fishing boat. He was a sailmaker. And I realized that he was a fisherman, but I was in town to talk to fishers of men. This was a mistake. I said to him, "Mister, come with me. We're going to meet God." And because I had a few dollars in my pocket, he came with me. We could drink later. We got down to the mission, the services had already begun. Tex Francisco was at the door, and he barred us from coming in because we were too obviously drunk. And push was coming to shove, and I was getting ready to get my usual beating when Ebby showed up. And he sized up the situation. He said to Tex, "I'll sponsor them in. I'll sit on them. If they act up, I'll scoop them and get them out of there." And I got into the mission. For those, again, that recall the joint, the smell was overwhelming. These lads have been living in their clothes for years. Their body waste, an integral part of their body. Urine-soaked trousers, the smell of alcohol was pervasive. The boiling pot of coffee up front with a big, big pot of beans. I can still recall it today. It was overwhelming. Me and my Brooks Brothers suit. Well, I sat amongst them, and Ebby got us a plate of beans and a mug of coffee, and I drank it. I don't know if it was the beans or the coffee or the alcohol, but I eventually began to mellow out. And I began to realize that these weren't a bad bunch of boys. They were just a little further down in their luck than I was. As I mellowed out, apparently I went into another one of those blackouts, because what happened after that was retold to me by Ebby the next morning. Seems that in my blackout, halfway through somebody's witness, I got up with the fin and came forward to accept Christ. And before you know it, I was singing old camp songs, playing the tambourine, and jumping for Jesus, and giving testimony myself about the evils of alcohol. And again, from Ebby's mouth, everybody sat in wonder of me. I had them spellbound. When he told me that the next morning, I was absolutely mortified, because I knew I didn't believe a word of whatever it was I said. I just knew that I could never go back to Manhattan again. The idea of some drunk coming up and saying to me, "You were great the other night at the mission," it appalled me. I also realized that this was really the onset of the insanity of alcohol, and I was on a downward slide that would never, ever, ever be the same again. I was finished. Abby didn't argue, he left. He said, "You had me convinced." Going out the door, he said, "Bill, you had me convinced. I thought you had it." And I sat home really feeling sorry for myself. Lois was at work. And then I realized something that I hadn't realized earlier that morning. When Lois was going off, I reached into my trousers pocket and I took out money and I turned it over to her. I realized that I had never done that in years. I never came home with money. I spent every dime I had. Before I come home, I'd be dead broke. I couldn't go buy a bar with a dime. Apparently something did happen. What it was, I don't know, but I knew that if I was ever going to pull myself back from the abyss that I was on, I had to find out. So I decided I would get sober. I would sober up and go back to the Oxford group and really take a good look. Now, how do you get sober? With my experience, you go into Towns Hospital. My brother-in-law paid, always paid, the $125 it took for the 5 days to sober me up. Well, I don't know about you, but if you're going to get sober, you should get drunk first. No sense going into the hospital with a hangover. What a waste of $125. And it seems I was foolish enough to give my money away to my wife. I only had 6 cents, a penny and a nickel. And it took a nickel to get in on the subway. So I realized you can't get drunk even in Brooklyn on a penny. So what I did do is I got dressed and I went out and I scrounged around a few of the stores in Brooklyn Heights until I came up with the one store that would give me credit. And actually, it was Lois's credit. And on her tick, I got 4 bottles of beer. Drank 2 right away because I was very thirsty. Wound up trying to give one away on the subway to a stranger. He wouldn't take it, so I drank that. And then wound up finally walking into Towns' hospital, waving the 1 bottle of beer over my head that I had left, spotted Dr. Silkworth, and in a drunken state said to him, "Doc, I found the cure." And he took one look at me, took one look at the bottle, and he said, "I see you have, my boy. You know where your bed is. Go upstairs and get into it." And I knew where my bed was. And I went upstairs, undressed, finished the bottle of beer, and went to bed. 3 days later, free of sedatives, free of alcohol, I lay in that bed full of remorse now. Self-pity, anger, rage, and total, absolute humiliation. I realized that I had just done another terrible thing. I had no intention of checking out the Oxford group, drunk or sober. No intention. I had just cost my brother another $125, and I also cost my wife not to speak to me. What a terrible, terrible thing to do. When I looked up and standing in the door, it was my friend Debbie. And the first thing I said to myself was, here's a fellow that practices what he preaches. I heard the staff mention how cold it was when they were coming in on shift, and here was my friend come out in that cold to see me. And all I could say was, here's a fella that really works his program. And all he said to me is, "Gee, Bill, I'm sorry to see you in here again. I really thought you had it the other day, but I guess I was mistaken. If you ever need any help, please don't hesitate to give me a call." And he turned to go, and I said, "Wait a minute, Abby. What was that little neat formula you had that you got from the Oxford people that got you sober?" He said, "Simple." He said, "You get honest, you talk it over with somebody else, you make up for the harm you've done, help other people, and you ask God for help, whatever God you can come up with, to do those 4 things. And he mentioned the G-O-D word again, and I said, "Thanks, but no thanks." I still gagged at the idea of a personal God. What a joke. What a waste. And I lay in that bed, and the evening wore on, and it got darker and darker in that room until finally, in almost total darkness, in that bed of pain, I sank into one of the worst depressions of my life. And I was no stranger to depression, but this was one of the worst. I kept going down and down and down until finally it felt that I was at the bottom of a pit, a deep, dark pit. And then, for one brief moment, again, one of those moments that Pete mentioned when he introduced me, for one brief moment, my proud obstinacy left me, and I found myself crying out more in anger, I think, than in pain. If there is a God, let him show himself to me right now. I will do anything. Anything. Let him show himself to me. The room lit up in an intense white light, and I was caught up in an ecstasy that words cannot describe. In my mind's eye, it was as if I were on a mountaintop, and a wind, not of air, but of spirit, flowed through my body. And it burst upon me that I was a free man. The obsession to drink left me, that obsession that absolutely pervaded my total being left me. Eventually, the ecstasy subsided, and now I found myself back in that hospital bed, but this time surrounded in a presence, a presence of pure joy. And I realized, this number one man, that I was a part, if only a tiny part, of a universe ruled in justice and love by a loving, compassionate, personal God. And all I could say was, so this is the God of the preachers. This is what they've been talking about all these years. Eventually, I have one of these inquiring, rational minds, and eventually the mind began to say, my God, Bill, this is the granddaddy of all hallucinations. This was that slide into madness that Dr. Silkworth talked about. This was the end. And I became frightened. So frightened that I got the nurse and I asked her to get Dr. Silkworth. And she did. He came and sat alongside my bed and I told him what happened to me. And he listened. And finally, I don't know where the courage came from, I said to him, Doctor, is this it? Am I going insane? And after a few minutes, his brow furrowed and he looked up to me and he said, no, my boy. No, I have never witnessed what has happened to you. But I've read about it in books, and it does sober up drunks, and I can tell you it's all you got. I saw you a short time ago, and I wouldn't have given you a tinker's damn for your life, but something has happened, and you better hang on to it. Because, again, it's all you have. And he left, and I slept like a baby. Next morning, I told Abby what happened, and he went out and came back a few minutes later, and with him he brought a book called The Variety of Religious Experiences by Dr. James, the Harvard psychologist. And he said, Bill, you'll find what happened to you in this book. It's the toughest book I ever read, but I devoured it, absolutely devoured it. And in it I did discover what had happened to me, the cash value of my experience, I call it, the scientific truth. This doctor had chronicled the number of experiences, some the illuminating type that I had, the sudden one that overcomes people. And then he also went on to illustrate the gradual experiences that other people have over a period of time through the help of other people or in fellowship or in service. They all undergo a transformation, a conversion. But the one thing that they all have in common, the one key ingredient, is a state of calamity. They are all in a sense of powerlessness and hopelessness before anything like this can occur. And this is what happened to me. I had had this sudden illuminating experience. And then typically alcoholic, I said, but why me? Why did this happen to me? And then I realized my drinking had so isolated me that it was as if I were in a cave. And my friend Ebby, well, first, my family over the years, and my wife in particular, stood outside that cave asking me to come out, and I couldn't get out. I couldn't find my way out. And finally, Ebby, he showed up outside the cave, and finally, after having been a captive in a similar cave, he entered mine. He knew the way. And he took me by the hand, and he led me out. One cave dweller helping another, one alcoholic helping another. And I knew that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to help other people like myself. I left the hospital. I joined the Oxford Group. And I came forth. And the next 6 months, I talked to thousands of drunks. And nobody, I mean nobody, listened to what I had to say. I couldn't sober up a soul. Because I was convinced if anybody had to undergo experience like mine, they had to be on top of a mountain, have this bright light and the wind, not of air, go through their body. They ran away from me, all convinced that what had happened to me was nothing more than a hallucination. Some of them used to jokingly say, Bill, tell us what you were drinking that day so we can avoid it. That was my total experience. Finally, in desperation, I went back to see Dr. Silkworth, and he told me, after I asked him the advice, he said, Bill, I first said to him, I'm sorry, why can't I help people, Doc? I said, my friend can help me, Ebby can help me, and I can't help others. Why can't I do that? And he said, Bill, I'm going to give you some advice. You can take it or leave it. I've listened to you talk to some of our patients here, and I want to suggest that you lay off the God business. Don't talk about God to a drunk. Talk drunk to a drunk. And after you make the connection, one alcoholic talking to another, talking about the lies and the losses and the deceit and the pain and the anguish and the heartbreak, once you make that connection, then talk about the spiritual program. But make the connection first. And I began to do that, and they stopped running away. Nobody got sober, but they stopped running away. And then friends, family friends, began to say, hey, when is Bill going to go back to work and get Lois out of that damn department store? And I heard it. And I realized that they were right. I wasn't any good in the drunk business, so I began to look for some action down on the street. And finally, I heard of a deal going down in Akron, and I cut myself in for a piece of the action. But folks, before I go to Akron, I got to stop for a few minutes and take a break. I'll see you in a few minutes. Thank you very much.